Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Truth and Movies. Today, Emma Stone, Steve Carell in Battle of the Sexes. The tale of when Billie Jean took Bobby Riggs to court to see who really has the fairer sets. Then, Suburbicon. Matt Damon, Julianne Moore and bizarre tonal shifts in George Clooney's clumsy clunky Coen clone about a perfect community's dark secret. Plus, here's one he did earlier. Film Club revisits Clooney's 2005 tribute to the heroes of the McCarthy era. Good night and good luck. It's Truth and Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. It certainly is. This week featuring Adam Woodward.
Hello.
One of our regulars. And also Hannah Woodhead.
Hi.
Hi, Hannah. You just joined the Little White Lies team.
I did. It's my fourth week.
Really?
Yeah.
All right. In very much the deep end. And you've been with us to see Battle of the Sexes and Suburbicon, and we'll be hearing your thoughts on those later. If you'd like to send us your thoughts, listeners, email address is truthandmovies@tcolondon.com, or there's @LWLies on Twitter, the Little White Lies Facebook page, or the Little White Lies website has its own comment section as well, which Steve Berkery has been all over this week. First of all, he's saying, you're doing Suburbicon, how come you're not doing a Coen Brothers film for your film club? And he suggested for that Miller's Crossing. I don't think they've ever surpassed that. Possibly controversial, though I do love Miller's Crossing. Gabriel Byrne.
I think my favourite Coen Brothers movie changes like every week.
Really?
Yeah. Mm.
Okay. Hannah, what's your Coen Brothers favourite?
Mine's Fargo. Always.
Is it?
Yeah. Always and forever, Fargo.
That's interesting in light of this week's Suburbicon, I would venture. But anyway, Steve Berkery continues to say, listening to the pod discuss Dog Day Afternoon prompted me to rewatch I Knew It Was You, Rediscovering John Cazale, one of my favourite documentaries about cinema. He only appeared in 5 movies, says Steve, but all were nominated for Best Picture. There are great interviews with Meryl Streep, Pacino, Coppola and other luminaries. And there's an extended Pacino interview on YouTube. This is I Knew It Was You, Rediscovering John Cazale. That sounds fabulous. Have you ever come across that documentary?
No, I've not actually, but I will check that one out.
Right.
I'm a big fan of his.
Yeah, I had no idea. 5 pictures and all were nominated for Oscars. Mm.
And all in a well, obviously a very short space of time as well, I think.
Yeah.
5 or 6 years.
Can you name the others? So we got Godfather 1 and 2.
The Deer Hunter, I think.
Ah, The Deer Hunter. Dog Day Afternoon, we're missing one.
You're putting me on the spot.
Yeah, we'll come back to you. Excellent. All right. Well, so much has happened since we were last here talking to you. Hannah, you went to see The Florida Project and found it.
Sad.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was really excited to see it. Everyone said how brilliant it was. And I was kind of preparing myself for this really sort of joyous experience.
But without in any way spoiling the storyline.
No, I think it's just prepare yourself. It's not all sort of Walt Disney, which is great. It's a really beautiful film and brilliant performances from some really young kids. And the always brilliant Willem Dafoe.
Isn't he good?
He's so good.
Yeah.
So good.
What we can talk about, though, is the continued fallout from the absolutely terrific Justice League. See it now if you haven't. See it again just to reappreciate the magnificence of this brilliant DC superhero yarn. It's done so badly at the box office, Adam, that they're now saying Ben Affleck must go.
Well, I'm not sure how much that's kind of linked, because I think Matt Reeves, who's directing The Batman, which is supposed to be shooting next year.
Oh, yeah.
He reportedly doesn't want Ben Affleck for the film, regardless of how this current one has performed at the box office. I think they're now projecting it's going to lose between $50 and $100 million, which, considering it had a budget of $300 million, is quite a big hit for Warner Bros.
Mm.
I think that just about covers the cost of Henry Cavill's mustache, though, so that's good.
Yeah. Lots of good tweets this week saying that, you know, the problem with this movie is that it didn't have a good villain, and why did they get rid of the mustache? They could have gone the whole hog with Evil Superman and
Evil Superman would have been good.
Mustachio twirling.
A lot of
villain.
People, that was their favourite bit when he goes kind of dark Superman when he first resurrects. I'm spoiling elements of the film, but to be fair, it's a terrible film. Don't go and see it. But anyway,
we put out a sort of cheeky tweet yesterday just asking if Ben Affleck is to be replaced, who would be the worst choice for the role.
I saw Michael Gove as one of the nominations. But
yeah, Gove and Boris Johnson were quite popular.
Right.
And someone actually suggested James Richardson.
Yeah, I think I'd nail it.
I think I thought that was doing a disservice.
I've got the nipples for the part.
You've got the chin for it, I think, as well.
Yeah. Also, Sacha Baron Cohen I saw nominated, which I would love to see. Anyway, so that's Justice League. But you have got news of another film that we didn't particularly enjoy that is heading towards a sequel.
Yeah, so Murder on the Orient Express is getting a sequel. And it is, of course, Death on the Nile.
Right.
I mean, at the end of the film, they say there's been a death on the Nile.
There's been a death on the Nile.
So it does set it up for a sequel. And I suspect that this one was greenlit before the film came out. And it's actually performed quite well. People have gone to see it.
So. We went to see the screening together, didn't we?
Yeah.
And there was a ripple of excitement when Poirot says, oh, a death on the Nile.
Yeah.
At the end.
But then they're also saying they're not sure who's going to play Poirot, whether it's going to be him. I don't know. It's
got
bizarre.
To be him.
I think
Surely.
They should recast it. I think every role should be recast.
Like
controversy. I'm going to suggest get a Belgian.
Yeah, why not?
Why not? All right. Ha! Movies, huh? They don't stop making them. Let's look at then the first of this week's releases, Battle of the Sexes. Battle of the Sexes is a true story of the 1973 tennis match between world number one Billie Jean King and the former tennis champ Bobby Riggs. Here's the moment when Miss King and professional misogynist Bobby Riggs announce their contest to the world.
Now, don't get me wrong. I love women in the bedroom and in the kitchen. But these days, they want to be everywhere. They want to be doing everything. Where is it going to end? Pretty soon, us fellas aren't going to be able to go to a ball game. We're not going to be able to go fishing. We're not going to be able to stop and have a drink after work. And that's what this whole women's lit thing is about. And it's got to stop. And Bobby Riggs is the man to stop it. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Custer's last stand. This is the lobber versus the lever.
Keep talking, Bobby. The more nonsense you spell, the worse it's going to be when you lose.
Well, I'm the ladies' number one. I'm the champ. Why would I lose?
Because dinosaurs can't play tennis.
I'm going to put the show back in chauvinism.
Hmm. Well, their eventual tennis match became, I believe, the most watched sporting contest in the world.
Oh, is that right?
Back in ye olde 70s. Adam.
Yes.
This is about so much more than just a tennis game, though.
Well, yeah, ostensibly, that's the way the film sets itself up. And I have no doubt that this was a big deal at the time.
Mm.
For people who don't know, and actually listening to that clip, you hear Bobby Riggs describe himself as the world ladies' number one. And the thing I didn't know about this story was that he actually had a match against Margaret Court before this and beat her. She was the world's women's number one at the time. So the film sets up nicely this, you know, aging, sort of semi-retired guy who's a hustler. He you know, is a serial gambler as well. And, yeah, it sets up nicely this idea of him basically not necessarily wanting to completely destroy the women's game or these players specifically, but just wanting to go in for like one last paycheck.
Yeah, and he just loves stunts as well, whether it's playing in flippers or playing while holding a couple of dogs on a leash, all that kind of thing. But the tennis match itself, I don't remember it. It doesn't mean that much to me. But what I really enjoyed about this film was the way that it also gives you a little kind of window on the dawn of the WTA, how they set all that up, which I had no idea that Billie Jean King herself was behind the formation of that. And also that whole, I mean, the whole kind of fight for equality.
Well, that's the most interesting thing about this film, I think. You have all this preamble almost to the match itself with Emma Stone's character and Sarah Silverman, who plays the sort of yeah, she sort of rallies all the women. She's like their manager, I guess. And they do set up the WTA in opposition to Bill Pullman, who's the head of the American Lawn Tennis Association at the time, who's very, you know, has a very hard line on equal pay and, you know, all the kind of top ranking tournaments that they control. They basically hold all the cards. So the women are like, well, you know, we bring in the crowds. Why don't we just set up our own tournament and our own tour, which is what they do. And I found that really interesting, actually, seeing how they kind of went about that.
Mm. It's all shot through as well with the kind of glorious 70s sunny optimism. Even though there's a lot of hard work, there are some knocks as well that they take, but there's just a great vibe to this film.
Yeah, it's a bit of a crowd pleaser, I think, as well. And it's quite accessible. I think it's dealing with some interesting themes. Obviously, it feels quite relevant given certain, you know, the sort of climate of today. But not only does it deal with the kind of misogyny and the sexism and the pay gap and things like that, but also deals a little bit with Billie Jean King's sexuality. Mm. For people who don't know, she is gay, and, you know, it touches upon her relationship with, not so much her coming out, but her own sort of sexual awakening, I guess. Mm. And that isn't necessarily like a really big part of the film, but it's an important part of her character, and I think the film handles that in a very sensitive way.
Yeah. Jonathan Dayton and Valerie Faris helming this one. They previously directed Steve Carell in Little Miss Sunshine. Danny Boyle producing. What did you make of it, Hannah?
I had really high expectations. I'm a big Emma Stone, big Steve Carell fan, and I loved Little Miss Sunshine. But I was a bit disappointed. I think for me, when I was watching it, there was a sense of like, it didn't tell the whole story. And it ended on this sort of hopeful, you know, note, like everything's going to be fine. And for me, this is an ongoing battle. It's 40 years since this film took place, and female athletes are still fighting for equal pay.
Mm. Female broadcasters, female pretty much everything.
Yeah, yeah. So it just seemed a
female
bit...
Female actors.
Yeah, it seemed a bit strange that they chose to sort of end the story there. But I thought that the casting was brilliant. Emma Stone and Steve Carell were both really, really, like, compelling to watch.
It has this like where are they now coda, but it doesn't include any information about what the pay gap is like in tennis specifically now. And you know, you have very high profile disputes going on, and people like Andy Murray's been very outspoken about it and trying to make sure that the women do get the same prize money as the men. So I agree with you. I think the film, it presents this very hopeful story in a very accessible way, but at the same time, it doesn't really... And maybe it would be just a bit too much of a downer to leave you realising that 40 years ago, this event happened and actually it didn't have that big an impact. And I think the film struggles...
In some ways, the match itself potentially doesn't, but maybe the formation of the WTA was a huge step.
That's it's the not... bigger thing, and it almost uses the match as a way into that. And actually, the match itself... to all intents and purposes, is a pretty drab event. And, well, you know, they do really try to inject more drama into it than perhaps was even there. But
yeah, it's a hustle, a bit of a sideshow. And the film, deep down, I think, is aware of that. But, I mean, it's an entertaining finale. It's by no means, as you say, Hannah, a definitive study of the rise of women's wages in tennis. But I found it a very entertaining film. My only issue, apart from the slight anticlimax of the game at the end, was Alan Cumming, actually, as the flamboyant dress designer, who I thought it was less a performance, more a party turn that he put in. But apart from that, I thought, yeah, this cast was fabulous. Carell lights up the screen. Emma Stone does an outstanding job of a not always desperately accessible character, Billie Jean King.
Yeah, she's quite guarded. And, you know, even though she's with this group of women that she's on tour with, you know, they have a certain camaraderie, but she doesn't seem particularly close to any of them. She's a little bit out on her own, and she's very much got this idea of she's number one, and she's almost carrying the weight and the burden of this. Actually, one thing I thought was quite interesting was not really knowing much about Bobby Riggs' character at this time. I went into this assuming that he was just this rampant misogynist. And actually, when you find out it's all a complete act, and he is just kind of showing up for the cameras, you realise how easily he ended up sort of manipulating everyone, and her especially, actually, into making this match happen. Because although there's a symbolic element to it, and it means maybe more to her than it does to him, it's a very self-indulgent thing for him. And he's clearly just doing it for a last shot of the limelight and a final paycheck. And yeah, everything is like played into his hands a little bit.
Of course, this follows hard on the heels of another tennis flick that recently came out, Borg v McEnroe, or if you're listening in Sweden, Borg, which I think our opinions were mixed on. I really enjoyed it. Adam, you and David weren't so keen. Is this a better film?
I liked it more. I think it works better as a sports movie, first and foremost. I mean, the tennis scenes themselves are more entertaining. Mm. And I think the characters, if not in real life, are more interesting. They're certainly rendered with a bit more depth here. And right. Emma Stone and Steve Carell are just fantastic.
They certainly are. Did you see Borg v McEnroe?
I did, yeah. I liked it, but I thought that it should have really focused more on McEnroe. I think he's a bit more interesting. Oh. And I think this is why I liked Battle of the Sexes more. They had these two big personalities and they were both sort of really captured a lot better. It felt a lot more sort of peppy and accessible for someone like me who doesn't really follow tennis.
Right. Okay. Do you want to give it a score?
Yeah.
Or three?
Anticipation, I give it a 4. I was really excited. And then I think enjoyment, and in retrospect, it's a 3 and a 3 for me.
Are those good threes? I don't know what you're, how your kind of 1 to 5 stands.
Yeah,
is that a good thing?
I think
is
it's like a solid, like it's yeah, watch the film.
Okay.
I think, yeah.
Adam?
Yeah, I'd go high threes across the board.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, I'd say anticipation of 4 for me because it's got Steve Carell in it and I really enjoyed it at the time and I look back on it with a kind of warm glow, so that certainly 4s across the board for me. It's interesting, actually, we were talking about Will Ferrell last week and actually we had Sid emailing in saying, I can't believe 3 film professionals I don't know how to pronounce Will Ferrell's name. Steam coming out of my ears. Check it out. He sent us in a little YouTube pronouncer. Okay, Will Ferrell. But David touched on this last week, the fact that Steve Carell consistently makes just outstanding choices and really interesting choices of movies, whereas Will Ferrell, he's such a talent, but just makes utter dross now.
Well, he did Stranger Than Fiction maybe 10 years ago now, which is more of a kind of serious role. But yeah,
which Sid recommends as a film club, actually.
Which I saw at the time and kind of liked, but would be interested to revisit. And I think he does his sort of mainstream comedy shtick.
He's had a couple of indies. He was in Everything Must Go, which is quite good. I think when he gets the chance to do these things, he's okay, but
surely he could take the chance whenever he wants. He's Will Ferrell.
Yeah, but I don't know. He just doesn't seem to take these chances.
Yeah.
I don't know. He's a strange one.
Steve Carell is just a bit more relatable and a bit more human. I don't know. Will Ferrell's this big, larger-than-life character. And Steve Carell, thinking of recent stuff, we saw him in the new Richard Linklater film.
Yeah.
And actually, when Foxcatcher came out a few years ago,
I loved Foxcatcher.
I interviewed him and Bennett Miller, the director for it, and Miller was basically saying that he cast Steve Carell because he's such a likeable, benign character in everything you see him, basically.
Have you seen The Way, Way Back?
I have, yeah.
Yeah, in which he's really not a benign or likeable character, but again, does a just outstanding job. And what is an absolutely terrific movie, featuring one of those actors who I will watch a film for, Sam Rockwell.
Oh.
That's a good one. Like, who are the actors that... doesn't matter what they're in or what the film is about, what the story is, you will just watch it with them in.
Yeah.
I think Sam Rockwell was for me for quite a while, and then he stopped being in so many good things. And
possibly, yeah.
Maybe after Moon he wasn't in that much good stuff, but...
probably.
He's back on track, I think.
All right, good. Who's your... Anna, do you have someone who you will roll up to the cinema for?
Probably Steve Carell.
Really?
I love Steve Carell.
Yeah.
Denzel.
Denzel Washington.
Oh, yeah. I will watch, and I actually when I worked at a video shop many years ago, it was sort of
a
like,
what?
Yeah, exactly. Kids ask your parents, but yeah, it was sort of like on its last legs a little bit,
right?
So nobody used to come in, and I did spend an entire day doing a Denzel marathon. Which
did
was
you?
Very enjoyable.
Okay, did you used to give people recommendations and that kind of thing?
I used to try,
right?
But mostly people just came in to rent the latest blockbusters.
I understand. All right, well, we'll be getting your thoughts on our second film, Suburbicon, right after this. Suburbicon centres on a peaceful, idyllic suburban community where, beneath the tranquil surface, there's both a simmering racial tension and a dark, disturbing secret. Matt Damon here receives a visit from a police officer investigating 2 crimes.
Mr. Lodge, I have a Lieutenant Hightower...
Tell him I'm not in.
You're on speaker, sir.
Sorry, Lieutenant. You've come at a very busy time.
Oh, I'm sorry to drop in on you like this. I wanted to clear something up that's just come to light. What happened to you?
Oh, horsing around with my kid.
He's got a mean right.
He does. So... any new progress on the investigation?
Well, actually, I was hoping you might be able to help me with another case. You know a character named Rizzoli?
No, Rizzoli? No.
He got killed in a vehicular on the turnpike a couple of days ago. Rizzoli. Frank Rizzoli?
Never heard of him. I'm sorry for his loss.
Of life? Yeah, I guess he probably is too.
Well, yeah, Matt Damon there. Part of a stellar cast. Julianne Moore. Oscar Isaacs here as well. And an absolutely amazing performance from young Noah Jupe. But no George Clooney. I think it's the first time he's directed a film, but hasn't appeared in it. Hannah, what did you think?
I was not a fan. I came out, I saw it with a friend of mine and came out and I was very angry about it.
Really?
He really
what made you angry?
I just think it was so misguided. There's this whole undercurrent of racial tensions going on and it just felt like totally sort of, you could see what Clooney was trying to do and he just did it really badly.
Yeah. I must admit, I felt really uncomfortable about it as well. And whilst I recognise that he's got great intentions, it just feels weird decorating this kind of a capery film with really horrible scenes of racial injustice and abuse.
Yeah, it felt like there were two different films going on and it didn't match up. It should have matched up. I can see the intention was there, but the execution was not. Mm. And I just thought it was quite insulting for a sort of very privileged white man to go and make a film like this.
Although you have to salute the fact that he's at least trying to air the issues. But yeah, it did come across.
Yeah, I feel like he's got a platform where he could be allowing other filmmakers to make these films rather than steamrolling in there and trying to do it himself. I feel like it just felt very, like, in a year that we've had Get Out, which is one of the best films about sort of racial tensions in America, it felt completely just missed the point.
We like to make films about, you know, with messages. The message, unfortunately, this is steer clear and see something else, I suspect, Adam.
Yeah, well, we should say, I think that, so early on in the film, in this white picket fence community, a black family moves in and it's a big shock to the very white bread families that live there. And you kind of think, okay, where is he going to take this? Is he going to really latch on to this simmering tension around the time? And he kind of just uses it, like you say, as dressing, and it's kind of happening in the background all the time. And you never really get to know the characters, the black family themselves. They're just sort of there, and bad things happen to them. But that's not the story he actually really wants to tell. Mm. But it becomes very much more about a crime which takes place within the Matt Damon's family. And it does take some odd decisions here, I think.
Mm. What else angered you about this, Hannah? Or were there things that you liked?
I liked Oscar Isaac. I thought there was not enough of Oscar Isaac. There's never enough of Oscar Isaac in films. I think Julianne Moore, her character was just very sort of, I didn't really care what happened to her. Same with Matt Damon. I think Matt Damon, it was a sort of a strange performance from him. It was very, felt almost a bit half-hearted to me. Hmm. Like he didn't really commit. And there's a scene like quite late in the film, which is very much a Coen Brothers scene. You can tell they wrote the scene. It's very reminiscent of No Country for Old Men. Hmm. And you do get these sort of flashes of like really good script writing, but just like the execution is so off-putting and so poor. It gets to the point where you're just really glad it's only an hour and 45 minutes long.
Right. The Coen Brothers film, this reminded me of a lot, was Fargo, actually, without going too much into the plot details. But Clooney, having been in, what was it, 4 Coen Brothers films, has clearly decided to have a go at one himself. So he's got a script from the brothers. And all the way through, you can see he's gone for that kind of slightly subversive, the marriage of deadpan romp and also familiar things just slightly off kilter. But it never really comes together.
Yeah, he's made a few very different films now, and I think you can look at the films he's made around that with certain directors as having influenced whatever he's then gone on to direct himself, like Good Night and Good Luck, which we'll talk about later. He made that not long after working with Steven Soderbergh on The Good German. And again, this one, he's worked with the Coen brothers recently in Hail Caesar and obviously other stuff as well. But this is a script that I think they originally wrote in 1986, so it's been knocking around for a while. And you can kind of see there is the origins of like a Coen-esque story here. Specifically when Oscar Isaac turns up as like an insurance salesman, that's like the Fargo bit, which I kind of like that bit. The film definitely picks up when he's in it. But otherwise, it's like he's taken the seed of that story. I don't know whether it was originally set in this world. I'm guessing it was because the Coens, you know, they love period stories. They love this mid-century era. But what he does with it is just very bland, I think. He doesn't take it in a dark enough direction, if that's where he's going. It's not humorous enough. The performances, I think, are totally off and the casting's totally off.
Can I offer one exception? I mean, apart from Oscar Isaacs, who we all agree is great, I thought Noah Jupe, as the son of the Gardner family, one possibly the most central figure of the entire film, was absolutely brilliant.
He's terrific.
He was carrying it. Yeah, he was brilliant. And his interactions with the neighbour, actually, the son of the Black family, were like, they just sort of pulled on my heartstrings. These two sort of 8-year-olds were really, really brilliant.
He was in The Night Manager. He's got a whole bunch of stuff coming up. He's in Wonder, which we're going to be talking about next week, opposite Jacob Tremblay, another of the rising stars of, you know, young acting.
Yeah,
good for him.
He is very, very good in this.
Mm. Hannah, overall, anything you want to say in Clooney's favour here?
I really liked that film he made, Confessions of a Dangerous Mind.
Oh, did you? That was his first one. Yeah, interesting.
Yep.
Sam Rockwell, of course.
Of course, yeah. Maybe he just needs to work with Sam Rockwell some more. I think I came out of Suburbicon feeling quite angry that it even existed, which is not a good thing.
I know what you mean. Adam, we saw it together. I don't think either of us were particularly impressed. There was one scene with a silhouette, which had a kind of comforting hokiness to it, which I actually quite enjoyed. But beyond that, a stab at doing a Coen that completely misses.
It's just a real clash of tones. And that really does bleed through all the performances. You've got Julianne Moore doing this kind of Stepford Wives thing, which just doesn't work at all, I think. And yeah, Matt Damon, again, people love him, but I don't know. Has he been in that many good films?
Do people really love Matt Damon, or do they just think they love Matt Damon?
I think people really love Matt Damon.
Yeah, I think there's enormous good. Well, I was going to say goodwill.
I watched Downsizing at London Film Festival, and he was.
Oh. Yeah, interesting. Because that's one we'll be doing soon. Again, a kind of suburban, slightly removed from reality.
Similar, yeah.
Yeah, interesting. All right, numbers then, Hannah.
I was quite excited. I had 4, and then 2. I really did not enjoy it.
No. Adam?
I think a 3 for anticipation. A little bit of trepidation just because of George Clooney being such an unpredictable director. And I think maybe a 2 and then a 1. I mean,
right.
I would never watch this film again. I don't think I'd recommend it to anyone. And it's kind of a shame that it exists, I think.
All right. Well, I'll sign off on those scores. And we'll move on to then happier times for George Clooney in our film club.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Good night and good luck is this week's choice as Film Club. Terrific. Second film, sophomore effort from George Clooney, dealing with the brave efforts of Edward R. Murrow and his CBS team to take on the witch-hunting anti-communist senator Joseph McCarthy, careerist anti-communist, I would say, Joseph McCarthy. Here's the iconic moment in which Edward R. Murrow denounces issues which, much as with the Battle of the Sexes, are still so very current, dear listener, 60 years on.
We must not confuse dissent with disloyalty. We must remember always that accusation is not proof, and that conviction depends upon evidence and due process of law. We will not walk in fear one of another. We will not be driven by fear into an age of unreason if we dig deep in our history and our doctrine, and remember that we are not descended from fearful men, not from men who feared to write, to associate, to speak, and to defend the causes that were for the moment unpopular. This is no time for men who oppose Senator McCarthy's methods to keep silent, or for those who approve. We can deny our heritage and our history, but we cannot escape responsibility for the results. We proclaim ourselves, indeed as we are, the defenders of freedom wherever it continues to exist in the world. But we cannot defend freedom abroad by deserting it at home.
So here's one that Clooney got right, Hannah.
Yeah, I love this film. I remember studying this. I did a history degree and we studied it as part of our sort of module on 20th century America. When, you know, Clooney's getting taught in universities, I think that's quite an honour on his part. It is sort of the golden age of Clooney, the last like great film he did.
Oh, really?
I think so, yeah.
It was only the second one he did.
So. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
All right. Adam, listeners?
Yeah, we've got some good comments. Nick Gilbert just says, David Strahan, my man.
Is that how you pronounce it? Strahan?
That's how I pronounce it. Okay. But I'm sure someone will send us a YouTube clip.
Well, Sid, actually, who was on the YouTube thing earlier, said he's not a fan of this. It's somewhat typical of Clooney's socially conscious movies, heavy-handed preachiness, he says.
Oh, it's a bit harsh.
I mean, I don't know that you can call it heavy-handed preachiness. It depends where you sit on the political spectrum, I guess. But I'm not sure you could... McCarthyism was a bad thing. I mean, I'm not sure there's much of a grey area there. But yeah, fair dues. I mean, I actually think the great thing about this is that it's taking quite a dry subject matter, quite an unsexy subject matter, and lightening it up a bit. Mm. The iconic scene we've just heard, they follow it up with this brilliantly comic moment where they basically are waiting for the calls to come in from the listeners and someone's unplugged the phones, and it's really, really lovely. Anyway, let's read out some more. Banshee Babe at Banshee Babe. I thought it was well done. David Strahan is excellent. JC Von Pliskin says, haven't seen it in a few years but remember it being a bit perfect.
Oh,
that's high praise.
Yeah. My favourite one comes from Al Cook. It's brilliant. I had big hopes for Clooney, the director, after this. Alas, 'twas not meant to be, which is exactly how I feel.
That film, The American, do you remember about the hitman? He didn't direct that, did he?
No.
Siriana was another of the... Was that the one he did after this? Siriana, with Matt Damon, I believe.
Siriana, I think he did before this.
Was that before?
Yeah.
Okay.
This was after he'd been working, as I say, with Steven Soderbergh a little bit. I think they'd done Solaris and The Good German together.
Right. He mortgaged his own house in LA to help raise the film's budget, which was a reduced $7.5 million. He paid himself $1 each for writing, directing and starring. Clooney's father, I didn't know this, was a news anchor.
I think that explains a lot about Clooney. He's got that charisma.
Kind of see that, I think.
Yeah.
Mm. Kai Ross describes it as a knockout film, extraordinarily evocative of a jazzy pre-Mad Men America. I think that's a nice... If you are a fan of Mad Men in that kind of period of American history, then it's a fascinating watch.
Ian Roberts, even though it's set in the 50s, it has more to say about the war on terror than any film set in Iraq or Afghanistan, which I think is very true. It's still an incredibly relevant film. And I went to see Network at the National Theatre last week, and for me it kind of was a nice little companion piece about sort of the current way fake news is sort of dominating every single platform. The sort of the good fight against it by these sort of very brave journalists. It's been going on for, 60 years.
What numbers would you give Network?
Oh, Network's 5.55.
Is it?
Network is fantastic. Go and see it if you can.
All right.
How's Bryan Cranston?
Bryan Cranston was brilliant. It's the best he's been since Breaking Bad. Like, I think the thing he lacks in all his film roles, and especially in...
Trumbo?
It was quite reminiscent of Trumbo, actually, which, of course... Trumbo was backlisted,
same era,
so it all comes together. But the stage gives him this sort of like presence, and I'd definitely recommend if you can get tickets.
All right.
I was just going to say, on Good Night and Good Luck, I think the line that always stands out for me from that speech is the bit about not confusing dissent with disloyalty, which is something people could stand to remember.
So very, very topical right now. Indeed so. He always gets great casts together, doesn't he?
He calls all his mates in.
Well, there's so many good people in this who are just kind of on the periphery. And,
right.
And you have people like Jeff Daniels. I'd completely forgotten that Robert Downey Jr.
Yeah.
was in this.
Yeah.
Again, pre-Iron Man, so very much on the kind of comeback train still. But yeah, he's terrific. Frank Langella as well.
Yeah. A shout out as well to Central Casting's stocky cropped haired man in uniform, De Schwa, Glenn Morshower. I never knew his name. I looked it up after this, actually, because he turns up again. Whenever there's a colonel or some kind of top brass figure, he's there. He has not one but two army roles in the Transformers series. Do you know the guy I mean? The big, thick-set guy.
Envision him.
Anyway, there you go.
And we should give a shout-out to cinematographer Robert Elswit as well.
Yeah.
He does terrific work on this. Monochrome, beautifully lensed. He's really, really... I mean, he's up there in, like, the Roger Deakin bracket, I think.
Right. Although, isn't it easier to do it in black and white?
It depends. I mean, you can shoot on black and white, but it leaves you with fewer options in the grade. Or a lot of people shoot on colour and then, like, colour negative stock and then, like, basically convert it to black and white afterwards.
They?
Yeah, but I think this was actually shot on black and white film.
Right.
Also, pleasingly short film at 1 hour, 33 minutes, which is always good.
Always,
I think, especially
a short film.
When it's a political drama, I think it's good to kind of not outstay your welcome.
Indeed. Important message there as well. Super. All right. Well, that's good night and good luck. What are we doing next week, Adam?
Well, next week we're going to be reviewing a film called Wanda, which stars Jacob Tremblay of Room fame and other stuff. He's one of these annoyingly precocious young actors who just seems to be in everything.
Oh, so he's in that as well?
Yeah, and just inspired by that, I guess, we thought we'd pick out a great child performance. And the film Leon, a.k.a. Leon the Professional, as it was released in the States. It turns 20 this year.
No.
Natalie Portman giving an extraordinary performance as Mathilde. So, yeah, I thought we could revisit that.
Leon, I think I'm kind of falling in love with you. It's the first time for me, you know?
How do you know it's love if you've never been in love before?
Because I feel it.
Where?
In my stomach. It's all warm. I always had a knot there. And now, it's gone.
Matilda, I'm glad you don't have a stomachache anymore. I don't think it means anything.
What an exciting cast there as well, because Gary Oldman as the very, very bad man is terrific, as is, of course, Jean Reno. A good vehicle.
Great car chase scenes as well.
Yeah, featuring a Renault. Do you see? Anyway, so Wonder is one of the films. Our look back on yesteryear is very much Leon. And we're also reviewing a film called Happy End. What on earth is that?
It's the new one from Michael Haneke.
White Ribbons, Michael Haneke.
The very same. And it's a first film since Amour, I think. It's his first film since Amour, which is a beautiful film and an absolutely harrowing watch. Something I would never want to watch again, I think. Ditto The White Ribbon, actually. But this is like, I wouldn't put it in the same category as that, but it doesn't hit you with that same level of impact as those two. But it's like, it is good.
Okay, super. Well, do make sure you join us for all of that next week. In the meantime, if you want to let us know what we mispronounce, truthandmovies@tcolondon.com is our email address, or you can find us on Twitter @LWLies. There's Facebook, there's the website, that kind of thing. Anything else you want to throw in, Hannah?
Don't go and watch Suburbicon.
Right. Okay, just in case there was any lingering doubts. Adam?
No, I think that's it for me. I'm going to go and see The Florida Project again.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Excellent. All right, well, whatever you're going to be watching, listeners, in the next 7 days, I do hope you enjoy it, and we'll see you next week. This was a 7 Digital production.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.